Ugh, I swear, I'm literally just jittery from.
Oh my gosh.
That coffee. I think you poisoned me.
Oh my gosh. I know. I gave Sammy some really intense coffee. So, okay. So that's why you don't take a cup of coffee from somebody who works nights.
I mean, I used to work nights, but like I said, coffee has not affected me in a long time. So for it to affect me right now, you made it very strong.
You're like over the moon.
And I'm okay with, I'm living for it, but I mean, oh my God, I'm not even going to need to like shake the penny. My hands are just going to jitter it.
Yeah, that's perfect. We don't have to flip the
just let it like jitter in the cup.
Oh man.
So hey, hi.
Hi, hey.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa.
Yes. It has been 2 weeks.
Yes.
And
since our last confession.
Since our last confession. Forgive me, Father.
We have been naughty children.
Sorry, Daddy. I've been bad. Big difference, by the way.
40 lashes.
Big difference between forgive me, Father, I have sinned, and sorry, Daddy, I've been bad. Big difference.
Big difference.
But
hello,
hi.
Hi, hello. Good morning.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, whenever you're listening to this.
We are back like payday, the 1st and the 15th. Mm-hmm. You guys usually get episodes. We will go on a hiatus eventually, and you guys will have to miss us. Like, you know, it's just like when a boyfriend and girlfriend have to spend a little bit of time apart.
The absence were on makes a break.
Yeah, just don't cheat on us with the other podcasts. You guys just have to come back at the end. I mean, you guys can be. We're on a break. We're not like Rachel. Okay, we won't. You guys can Ross it up.
Yeah,
but come back. Ross it up. So
because Rachel is terrible, but exactly. So is Ross.
You know. So what's new?
Not much. Let's see. Okay, so when we're recording this, I am still here.
Yes.
In the area, still packing. I've got 26 days left until I move.
Sad.
I know. But when you guys are hearing this, I will already be in Mississippi.
And I will already be sad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, let me think. By the time you guys hear this, I will have been in Mississippi for a week.
Yay!
And a half, I think.
And I will have been so proud of you, but very sad that you will be leaving us. So, but that means that we have to record some super, super awesome episodes for you guys.
And boy, howdy, do I have some good ones for tonight.
Oh my gosh, so do I. I'm going to freak you guys out.
And then I'm going to finish up season 2 with a bang.
Yeah.
It's going to be big.
Jazz hands.
You're going to be excited.
Yay.
All of you are going to be collectively
too.
Excited.
Heck yeah.
So
we, anything new with the podcast this week?
I do have one thing that I want to bring up. And this is, by the time you guys are hearing this, it's going to be like months in the past. But so after our St. Patrick's Day episode came out where I talked about the Banshee, we actually got an email on our website.
Yay. Thank you so much. We love interaction.
I wanted to read it out loud because this is like our first like real like fan email. Other than my mom sending one, because my mom did send us an email to our website asking where a certain episode was. But but other than that, this is like the first real email that we've gotten. And this comes from Sarah. So Sarah said, "Hi there. Just had to comment about the latest episode, as I'm glad to hear I'm not the only kid who was scarred for life over that Banshee scene. I remember them playing that movie in my elementary school cafeteria. It's probably been 30 years since I last watched it, and I can still see that creepy greenish specter in my mind. I was so terrified after seeing that as a kid that for years I was scared to look out a window at night for fear I might see her. Anyway, love your show. Take care, Sarah."
Thank you, Sarah.
So, Sarah,
you.
Thank you so much for interacting with us and
reaching
sending
out.
Us a message. You guys are more than welcome to send us emails. You know,
yes.
Like, I mean, emails asking questions or just, like, leaving a comment. And, I mean, I don't see this getting, you know, out of control. So until the day where we get, you know, like 30 emails a day, we're going to try to read them out loud. So
yes, that'll be fun. So yeah, please interact with us. Please hit us up on our website, conspiriesandcryptids.com, and on Instagram, that's @Cryptopod, Twitter, everything. You guys reach out. We want to hear from you.
Yeah. Or even just send us directly an email to conspiriesandcryptids@gmail.com, because yeah, we would love to hear from you. This just floors what are you guys us and interested gets us in? So excited to know that people are listening and that people are enjoying what we do.
Exactly.
Because we're enjoying what we do.
Because we will continue to do this as long as you guys tell us that you like us. And even if you guys don't like us, we're still going to continue
to do this. We're still going to keep doing it. I was going to be like, we'll probably still keep doing it.
Someone will like us. It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere. But yeah, I actually went and I did end up watching that movie.
Yeah, you did. Good, yeah, good. Good. You celebrated.
Like, on St. Patrick's Day.
We didn't get a chance to meet up. But
I did watch two very good St. Patrick's Day movies. I watched Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Nice.
And then I also watched The Luck of the Irish.
Ah.
The old Disney Channel movie with Ryan Merriman.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Great movie.
I do.
Great.
I hung out in my my shamrock onesie that I have and put my shamrock belly button ring in and went and took a nap. So
nice.
So yeah, and I had a pretty easy St. Patrick's Day. I didn't go too crazy.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, but we did notice there were a lot of crazy people out on the road that day.
I believe it.
Yeah, nutters.
They were relying on the luck of the Irish to keep them from getting caught drunk driving.
Drunk at 2 in the afternoon. Come on. Start earlier.
Well, anyway, yeah. So that was St. Patrick's Day, which was literally
ago
like
now.
A month and a half ago when this comes out. But
so
there you go.
I'm sorry. This season is weird. Shall we flip a penny for your thoughts?
Let's do it. Is it my turn or your turn?
I'm going to shake it this time because you pick.
Okay.
Heads or tails? Who goes first?
Heads. Heads.
Ah,
back to Sammy goes first. Ah, so you had Women's Day to be in the limelight, and now it's back to my turn.
I did. Well, I'll take it.
Okay. So this topic was actually an accident that I found.
Oh.
I was actually doing research for hellhounds or like black dogs. And I don't know how I found it, but somehow during like my research for black dogs and hellhounds and all sorts of stuff, I discovered a different cryptid.
Oh.
That I was like, I have to do this.
I love rabbit holes.
And this is one of the most bizarre ones I've had.
Oh, sweet.
Okay, so we all know that there are reportedly millions of undiscovered life forms living in our planet's oceans. But what if I told you that there are even more undiscovered creatures living in a much larger ocean above our heads that we call the atmosphere?
Oh.
So what I'm talking about are known as atmospheric beasts.
I've never heard of this.
I had not either.
What's an atmospheric beast?
Okay. So for those who believe, atmospheric beasts are very fragile and lightweight creatures who are either native to Earth or are aliens that came from elsewhere. If the latter view is taken, then the atmospheric beasts are sometimes thought to have originated in the atmosphere of some other planet, but they can also be thought of as originating in interstellar gas clouds, so that they are, in effect, aliens without a native planet able to swim through space. Believers generally consider atmospheric beasts to be non-sapient, so non-like animals, basically,
yeah.
Just like a very low life form. So that even if these creatures did originate somewhere other than Earth, they still don't count as sapient extraterrestrials or just animals.
Weird.
Right?
Ooh, weird.
I know. And they just, like, swim around in the sky.
And they're just hanging out up there. So yeah. This is like chemtrails on a
Not
bizarre kind
even.
Of crack.
It's like if a chemtrail
was a being.
Came from Mars and
weird.
Was alive.
How weird.
Kind of.
I like it.
But they don't spew chemicals.
Yeah, but so they're, what
it's
do they do?
It's just like a living cloud.
Okay.
From another planet.
Weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
Maybe.
But you can't see them.
Planet. Yeah. You can sometimes.
Oh. Do tell. Go ahead.
All right. So description. They can change their density at will. They're usually metallic in color, though they can be invisible. They can become large and cloud-like. They can become invisible. They can glow. Might die if they come in contact with the ground. The more corporeal ones may have flippers, tentacles, eyes, and mouths. And then when they die, they turn into a gelatinous mass that may resemble a green, purple, gray, or iridescent jelly that evaporates into nothing within minutes, hours, or at the longest, a few days.
Weird.
Remember that because there is an actual thing that ties in with that.
Oh, okay.
So
remembering, stashing.
So stash that away because that's coming at the end when I do, you know, my possibilities.
Okay.
Of what they are.
Guys, bookmark it. We'll come back.
So we're going to get into some sightings now because there actually have been real sightings of these.
Hmm.
The first sighting comes from September of 1891.
Oh.
And it's also known as the Crawfordsville Monster. So the Crawfordsville Monster is probably the most well-known story about atmospheric beasts. On September 4th, two men were repairing a wagon when they looked skyward and were shocked to see what they described as a horrible apparition soaring above them. The men asserted that the multi-finned, rectangular, headless creature swam no less than 100 feet above them and that they gauged its size to be approximately 8 feet wide and 20 feet in length.
Boy.
It's big.
And
just
yeah,
floating
huge.
There above you.
Ooh.
Like this big floating 8 foot,
just 20
wide,
foot,
20 foot long thing.
Jeez.
The men would later confirm to reporters that the beast was definitely animate. So it was definitely moving around.
Ooh, weird.
The men watched in horror as the creature propelled itself through the heavens with its numerous fins and even circled above a nearby home. The monster then vanished as it traveled eastward, only to reappear moments later. This was about all the eyewitnesses could take, and the men chose this moment to abandon their repairs and flee for their lives.
Yeah.
Which, honestly...
Bye-bye.
I do not blame them.
No.
I would probably do the exact same thing.
Run for your life.
I
yeah.
mean, imagine if you just saw this, like, giant headless rectangle with fins. Because that's what they described it as. A giant, like, headless rectangle with multiple fins. Swimming around in the air 100 feet above your head. Which,
and it's in the 1800s, so yeah. They don't experience planes and...
No.
Weird.
No, they're out there repairing their wagon.
And it just
probably
flies overhead.
Getting ready to, you know, make the Oregon Trail and die of dysentery.
Oh, my God.
And they, you know, they see this giant floating swimming rectangle.
Oh, my, just die of dysentery. Just,
right?
Like... Just dysentery, take me now.
Yeah.
Cholera.
Like, consumption.
We're not going to ford this river.
They're not going to ford this fjord?
Fjord. anyway, go on.
Ford this fjord. The utterly bizarre creature would be easy enough to dismiss as a drunken hallucination or an outright hoax.
That's what it sounds like.
Were it not for the corroboration of another eyewitness with an impeccable reputation.
He was drunk, too.
The witness in question was one Reverend G.W. Switzer, a local Methodist pastor.
He's a drinker.
Who, along with his wife, also claimed to see the sky beast.
She's a drinker, too.
Okay.
Y'all are nuts. Oh, my God. That's insane.
Wait. When was Prohibition? No, that was the 30s.
The 20s, 30s. 20s, yeah.
Okay, so never mind. I was about to be like, nobody was a drinker because this was Prohibition. But no, this is 1890s.
This is why they drink.
And that's why we drink.
Not to step on their toes. But they are awesome people.
Anyway, as if this weren't enough, the following night, the thing returned. But this time, it did not just show itself to a handful of stranded observers. According to reports published by the Indianapolis Journal, hundreds of witnesses testified that they watched the anomalous airborne entity fiercely flapping in the night sky.
Oh, so now it's not even just like swimming over and like
flapping.
Swimming in space. It's like
it's gelatinously morphing across the sky.
Weird.
Yes. Observers described an identical beast to the one seen the night before, but this time they noticed a cycloptic flaming red eye. I love that word, cycloptic.
Oh, cycloptic
flaming red eye.
So, like what Sauron is.
Yeah.
Like, chilling up in the sky in a big flappy rectangle.
A rectangular eye of Sauron.
Rectangular flappy eye of Sauron. Okay.
Rectangular flappy eye of Sauron. Yes.
Yes.
Title. Calling it now.
Yes.
They also noted that the writhing beast emitted a wheezing, plaintive noise and squirmed in agony.
Oh. So,
ew. Ooh. Yeah. Well, wheezing.
Yes. Yes.
So the Crawfordsville creature undulated above the throngs of awed onlookers at a height of about 300 feet until it abruptly plummeted earthward towards a group of spectators. Those who narrowly avoided the apparent attack of this beast swore they could feel its hot breath as it rushed past them.
Ooh.
Right?
Mm.
You feel it.
Like,
on the back of its neck.
Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah, creepy.
Ooh.
So the second sighting comes from April 27th, 1961. Scientific journalist Bruno Djibouti.
Bruno Djibouti. I like it.
Was driving along the highway that ran adjacent to Monte Silvano Beach in Italy when he blew a tire. He immediately pulled over and began changing his flat. The job was proceeding smoothly when he noticed a bizarre multi-winged or possibly finned object soaring over the ocean at a low altitude. The strange craft was heading directly toward him at an incredible velocity, but much to his credit, Djibouti did not panic. Instead, he reached into the car and retrieved his camera. As the odd object passed overhead, it slowed and made a sharp northward turn. Djibouti managed to snap a single photo of the unidentified flying object before it accelerated out of sight. So I gotta find the picture.
It's fast too.
It's fast.
Oh, yeah. And you got a picture of it.
Yeah, this one. This one has a picture. Is this the 1960s?
I can't wait.
Yes. Wait. Hang on. I gotta make sure that I got the right one. 1961. Yes. Boop.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
Weird. Guys, yeah. It's like a weird triangle thing with like flipper.
It kind of looks like a little like squid made out of a hot dog. Like, you know how like sometimes in like little like Japanese bento boxes, they'll make like a squid or an octopus out of a hot dog.
Yeah.
But like cutting it in half and then splitting it.
It's kind of thorny.
Kind of looks like that.
Weird. And that was,
I think I'm thinking of a different one, but it looks weird. I am thinking of a different one. My bad. But it does look weird.
It does look very strange.
The next one comes from 1963, so just 2 years later, in the Northcliffe region of Johannesburg, South Africa. A real estate agent was taking pictures of available houses for a local newspaper advertisement when she captured an image of a truly unique UFO, or unidentified flying object. The object resembles what seems to be an odd cellular structure. So this is the one that she took a picture of.
Oh, it's like a honeycomb, and it's kind of, and that's like a real picture.
Yes.
That's
now, to me, it kind of looks like, when you see like a movie of like film, you know, like burning.
Yeah. And the start of a burn. Yes.
Yeah. Like the start of a burn hole in film.
You're right.
It kind of looks like that to me.
And it's a black and white picture. So that would also make sense that's what that is. That is kind of like the starting of bubbling of
burning
like
film.
Nitrite film. Yeah.
Yeah. Next sighting comes from November 3rd, 1973. On the afternoon of November 3rd, 1973, a Mexican banker and his family spied a strange object rocketing in a westerly direction over Cocoyoc, Mexico.
Hmm.
The banker's wife claimed that the object was roundish and did not resemble any traditional aircraft that she knew of. The banker stopped his car for a better look at the unusual object. He and his wife quickly exited the vehicle and watched as the unidentified flying object blazed across the brilliant blue sky. Thankfully, the banker had the presence of mind to grab his camera and managed to shoot a photo of the craft before it shot out of view.
Whoa.
Kind of looks like a blimp.
Yeah.
But a very metallic blimp.
Yeah, with these like weird kind of arm things around it that look like kind of maybe like a... That's so strange. There's no face to this thing. But I wonder why they deemed them beasts.
Probably because they have like fins and
they're
flippers
moving,
and stuff
like
that. And they're moving not
How
like a spaceship.
Weird.
So it's like these technically fall under the UFO category.
Yeah.
But they're not UFOs in the term of... flying saucer,
they're not a vehicle
kind of UFOs.
Yeah.
You know, they
Weird.
Don't look
they're just an object.
They don't look like, you know, like a piece of machinery or technology.
How strange.
So, yeah, UFO technically covers a it's very broad.
Yeah.
So, next sighting comes from July of 1999. Supposedly the object, which looks kind of like a stubby tentacled squid, was reportedly silent, exceedingly large and soaring at an incredibly high altitude and rate of speed. Some witnesses claimed that the UFO had lights along the base.
Hmm.
So this is the one that I was talking about that kind of looked like a hot dog that was cut apart.
Oh, yeah. It looks kind of like one of those hands you throw at the wall that's like sticky and it would...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it does. Oh, my God.
Splat.
Like the sticky hands.
That's very strange.
Yeah.
Ooh. I can't imagine that thing and then moving and like...
Right?
like undulating above people. It almost looks like it would be, you would like your screensaver.
Yes, it does kind of look like my screensaver. Next, or the last sighting I have, and there were a bunch more, but they were like very small. So next sighting I have is from New Zealand. A photographer named Michael White was shooting pictures of the sky when he noticed what he described as a strange-looking dark cloud. Apparently, the cloud remained immobile for the better part of a half an hour when it suddenly disappeared. White had managed to snap multiple photographs of the cloud, but it wasn't until he later developed the images that he realized how unique the entity was. In the photo, he discovered a mysterious object that resembled a sort of rippling, possibly organic, manta ray-like object.
Ooh.
The most intriguing part of White's story is that he claimed that he did not notice the object when he took the picture. White insisted that all he saw was a cloud that he described as being fibrous and peculiar looking. He even went so far as to state that he believed the weird cloud could sense that it was being filmed and vanished as a result.
Ooh.
So this one is the coolest looking one, in my opinion.
Which is so funny because, you know, when you're a plane and you're up that high, people are so tiny.
Yeah.
So for it to sense that it can, it does kind of look like a manta ray.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm finding interesting about all these pictures is that they do all kind of look similar, except for the one that looks like a bubble.
The one that looks like a film.
Yeah, that one doesn't look similar, but the rest of them
kind of do. They look like a UFO or like a spaceship, but if the spaceship was alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. That's or like something. A giant, like, jellyfish in the sky.
Bizarre.
Yeah. That's super weird.
How strange.
So explanations as to what they are is that they're just weird clouds, just strange, weird, anomalous clouds. Misidentified, like, flying saucer UFOs. So those are the two explanations of what it is. But, explanations of like some of the causes of them, and this is where we get into like that thing that I told you to remember, mm-hmm. is that it's called star jelly, which is in itself a super strange phenomenon. Star jelly is a very real thing. It's also called astromixin or astral jelly. It's a gelatinous substance sometimes found on grass or even on branches of trees. There is no official scientific explanation for it. We don't know what it is.
I've never heard of this.
It's been around for ages. Yeah, we don't know what it is. And explanations for it have ranged from materials being the remains of frogs, toads, or worms to the byproducts of cyanobacteria to the paranormal.
Wow.
It is just this weird gelatinous material that can be found on the ground or in trees sometimes. And it evaporates and disappears without a trace within, like, a matter of minutes and hours.
Even if you try to collect it, it's gone out of the tube.
Yep.
Weird.
Yep.
And
they've never really, literally, to this day, they have never really been able to classify what it is or where it comes from. And, yeah, one explanation is it's a dead atmospheric beast that has come and touched the ground.
That just evaporates. That's so strange. Yeah. And then I imagine, you know, finding goo like that, you're not going to be all prepared with your collection kit and stuff, so you can't test it immediately. How strange.
There's no explanation for how it shows up or when it shows up. It's very random. And then, yeah, when it does, even if it's, like, collected, it evaporates and disappears without any sort of trace. Like, it leaves no sort of, like, kind of like fingerprint behind, you know.
There isn't like a snail trail after.
There's
it's
nothing.
Just gone.
It's gone without a trace. And it has been studied and they don't know what it is.
How bizarre.
Right?
Oh my gosh. I learned something new today.
So yeah, just look up like star jelly.
Star jelly. I will. I will. That's so bizarre. That's I wonder so if it weird. Has anything to do with my conspiracy today.
Ooh.
Mm. Ooh. That's a tease.
That is kind of a tease.
Oh.
I'm excited.
Maybe. We'll see.
Okay. So
we're gonna take a break.
We're gonna take our mid episode break.
Yep.
And then when we come back, Tess is gonna regale us with a tale.
Yeah, with a conspiracy. Yeah, okay. It's gonna be very exciting. So stick around.
Stick around. We'll be back.
And we're back.
Speaking of featuring people, we've got a contest coming up.
We sure do.
So the end of season 2 is June 15th. That's our last episode for the season. And then we're taking our summer break for the month of July. And we'll be back August 1st with season 3. But what we want to start doing is at the end of every season, or towards the end of every season, we want to open up a contest to design the next season's cover art. So we're opening up to submissions from all of our amazing artist friends to submit like cover album artwork for our season 3 of our podcast.
The deadline is July 15th because mm-hmm. we need to make sure we get it in time for, you know, our purposes and stuff. But we're going to, you know, we'll feature your name. You'll be featured on our website, some of our merchandise, you know, logos, and it'll be, you know, a lot of us.
Kind of a way for us to help support you and get your name out there.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll be sending you guys some little goodies as well if you win and, you know, all sorts of stuff. But so if you have a submission, you can submit it to conspiraciesandcryptids@gmail.com. Or if you have any questions or anything, you can reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, @CryptiPod. We'll be posting about it here in the next couple of days or so.
And I'll make a little graphic for you guys.
Nice. So anyway, let's get into your conspiracy.
It is my turn. So according to recent reports, California is officially out of a drought after 7 years.
God,
yes,
thank God.
After all that rain we got. So awesome, you know, but isn't Sammy leaving after like 7 years here in town?
Yep.
So.
And I'm taking the drought with me.
So thirsty.
Watch out, Mississippi. I'm thirsty.
Oh, so thirsty. But all that aside, that means we've got tons, and I mean tons of snow up in the Sierra. And trust mm-hmm. me, I would love to go up there and play with it. I have a fantastic snowsuit, but there are just so many people up there.
Yeah.
I don't even want to bother.
Well, you know, they're open until the 4th of July this year.
Exactly.
So you've got plenty of time.
I'll be skiing and shorts.
Yep. And nobody else probably will. So you'll have the whole mountain to yourself.
Exactly. Well, it actually reminded me when you did your April Fool's episode. Mm-hmm. That there were people that were like tearing their way out of tents with the Walla Walla White Snake.
Yes.
And So it reminded me of the Dyatlov Pass incident. It refers to the deaths of 9 ski hikers in the northern Ural Mountains of the Soviet Union between the 1st and 2nd of February of 1959.
Okay. I've never heard of this. No, thank you. Oh, my God. But yeah, I've never heard of this. I'm excited. Go.
Third time I've said that joke, guys, and still laughs.
It's still funny. I love puns.
I'm so glad.
I love puns.
Anyway, so they died under very, extremely severely... unclear circumstances.
Okay.
During the night, something caused them to tear their way out of their tents and flee the campsite in their skivvies. After the bodies were discovered, the Soviet Union authorities determined that 6 died from hypothermia, 3 showed other signs of physical trauma, 1 had a fractured skull, and 2 others had major chest fractures, and 1 team member was missing their tongue and eyes.
Ew.
What the heck happened?
I mean, that seems a very oddly specific for it to be like a animal attack to just take out the tongue and eyes.
Yeah. And only one person. It gets very strange. Weird. It gets even weirder than that. So I'll go back to the beginning, though. So in 1959, a group was formed for a skiing expedition across the northern Urals. Each member of the group, 8 men and 2 women, were experienced grade 2 hikers with ski tour experience and would graduate to the next grade when they returned from this trip.
Okay.
These guys were no joke.
So they're not amateurs.
Exactly. Grade 3, the next where they were, would be, mm-hmm. is the highest certification available at the Soviet Union at the time, requiring hikers to traverse 300 kilometers total.
Oh, so they really weren't amateurs.
Exactly. So okay. They were almost
professional.
Exactly. Or if I mean, probably even considered professional now. They're just showing off at this point.
Fair. Okay.
So
that's like getting a PhD after you got your master's degree.
Exactly. So the goal was to reach Otorten, a mountain that was 10 kilometers or about 6.2 miles north of the site of the incident. So
okay.
they were almost there. They had a little ways to go, but
right.
They were almost there.
Mm-hmm.
The route was estimated as a Category 3, the most difficult at the time.
Yep.
The experienced trekking group, who were all from the Ural Polytechnical Institute, had established camp on the slopes of what translates now to the Dead Mountain in an area now named in honor of the group's leader, Igor Dyatlov. Igor Dyatlov was 23 years old. He's a radio engineering student at Ural Polytechnical Institute. He gathered the everybody together and students from his university. Uh-huh. Yay, road trip.
Road trip to literally Death Mountain.
To Death Mountain. Yay.
Let's take a road. That's like Hobbit levels of stupid. Let's take a road trip from the Shire to Mount Doom.
Let's go.
Literally what they did, only in the snow.
I mean, do these people look like they really feared snow?
They look like hobbits.
They kind of do.
Snow hobbits.
They look like fun hobbits. This lady just looks like she's not having it.
She looks like Mrs. Trunchbull from Matilda.
Yeah, if that's a lady.
Let me look again. I don't want to assume genders, but... Honey, that looks like a man.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
You don't know.
We're not going to assume their gender.
Either way, they look
like Miss Trunchbull.
That's true. They do. So anyway, there were also a bunch of other people that were, oh no, I lost my script. Oh God, hold on. Okay, stand by. Okay. Then there was also 21-year-old Yuri Doroshenko, 20-year-old Ludmilla Dubinina, 23-year-old Yuri Krivonoshenko, 24-year-old Alexander Kolotov, 22-year-old Zinaida Kolomogrova, 23-year-old Rustem Solbolden, who's 23. Yeah, like I said that. Nikolai, also 23. Alexander Zolotoryov, who's 38.
I'm living for your pronunciations of these Russian names.
I'm actually pretty damn close, too. I'm a little impressed with myself. It's probably I had rum earlier, so it wasn't.
That's not a Russian drink.
That's not a Russian
drink. If it had been vodka, maybe, but rum, not so much.
But anyway, so then there was also Yuri Yudin, who's 21, but he did not die on the trip. He left the expedition due to illness and died in 2013 at the age of 75.
A coward.
This was another picture of the group. They look like...
They look like snow
bits. They look like fun people. I'm sorry, guys. I keep hitting the wrong button on
the
iPad.
Like I said, they look like snow hobbits. Snobbits.
Snobbits. Lay. These people died. Jeez.
Have some respect.
God. Okay.
I'm sorry. My Everybody bronchitis else come is with kicking me. In, too.
Let's leave Sammy behind to wallow in his...
I am not going to be ashamed of snobbits, okay?
Anyways, so they were looking for a... it's always good practice to tell people before you go climbing or anything, to tell them where you're going before you leave.
Yeah, of course.
And who you're going with and, like, when you expect to reach your destination. So Iger did this, and he made an agreement with his sports club that they would send a telegram as soon as they had returned to the town that they started in and to expect them there no later than February 12th.
Like a singing telegram?
Yeah. They were going to send back what are they called? Valentinegram? Cupidgram? I don't know.
I just know what singing telegrams are.
Anyway, no, I doubt they were going to sing. I'm sure they would be very much more official than that. I have a lot more script to get through, Samuel.
Okay, I'll stop.
So the group arrived by train at a town in the center of the northern province of Sverd... Oh, my... Okay, anyway, this one area.
Russian town.
I'm really sorry. In the early morning hours of January 25th, 1959, they took a truck to a lorry village. That was the last settlement before, like, in the north, before you get into the really, really rough stuff.
Okay.
There, they chowed down on a few loaves of bread, and while they were there, they got a good night's rest before departing in the morning. They began their trek toward Ortorten from that town, called Visay, about a day later. That's where they were supposed to send the telegram
from.
Right,
okay.
And Yuri Yurdin actually returned, he turned back about a day into the trip because he had several health ailments, rheumatism and a congenital heart defect. And he complained of a knee and joint pain that made him unable to continue the hike. So he had to turn around.
How did he get to almost the highest level of, like,
you know what I was wondering is maybe it was all of that work. Maybe it was all of that hiking that caused all those problems.
Yeah, it's just that, to me, that seems kind of fishy.
It's
a lot of
wear and tear.
He's literally almost the highest level that they have, and now it's affecting him, like 6 miles from the finish line.
I mean, you never know, unless he already started with a heart defect.
He's 21. He shouldn't be that broken.
He's a little baby.
He's a baby.
He had to turn around. So,
okay.
So then... We only got part of the real part of the account from him up until that point. So then we've only got diaries and cameras that were found at the campsite that document the next few days of the expedition leading up to the incident. On January 31st, 3 days after Yudin left, the group arrived at the edge of a highland area and started getting ready to climb. They left a stash of goods and food and equipment that would be used for the trip back in a wooded valley nearby. The next day... the hikers started to move through the pass. It's believed that they planned to get over the pass and make camp for the next night on the opposite side. But because of worsening weather conditions, snowstorms, and decreasing visibility, they lost their direction and they got all turned around and they started heading west. Terrifying, but okay.
Yeah, that's creepy.
And they ended up toward the top of Dead Mountain.
Oh, God. Oh, God. This does not bode well. Okay, keep going.
Yeah.
I'm terrified for these people.
When they realized their mistake, the group decided to stop and set up camp there on the slope of the mountain, rather than moving less than a mile downhill to a more forested area or more cover. From a distance, because he quitter, Yudin hypothesized that Dyatlov probably didn't want to lose altitude that they had gained, so he decided to practice camping on the mountain slope.
Okay, yep.
As I mentioned, though, Igor told the sports club he'd send a telegram around February 12th, but when Yudin left the group, he told them to expect a response a little further out.
So right.
They were like, yeah, don't worry about us, keep going.
Gotcha.
Then when there was no response, nobody freaked out, but people started asking questions around the 20th.
Okay, so that was 8 days past what he said?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So like a week late, they're like, okay, now something might actually be wrong.
So then it took another 6 days on February 26th for searchers to find the group's badly damaged tent on Dead Mountain. Mm. And according to all the photography that we've come up to, these people have already been dead for almost the whole month.
Oh, God.
Because they think they died in like February 1st or 2nd.
Ugh. Okay.
Then Mikhail Sharvarin, the student who found the tent, said the tent was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty, and all the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind.
Here's what?
Yeah.
So they were naked?
They were naked. They were in the skivvies.
In the snow.
In the snow.
On the top of Death Mountain.
Yeah, they obviously didn't bode well for them.
I mean...
They caught their death.
On Death
Mountain.
So when
Grandma says, you catch your death when you're cold, she was right.
Yeah. Okay.
So here's what description of the scene. The tent was cut open from the inside. There were no survivors. All members left the campsite on their own accord, on foot. No one was dragged away. 8 or 9 sets of footprints left by people wearing socks or a single shoe or barefoot leading down toward the edge of a nearby woods on the opposite side of the path, about a mile to the northeast. After about 1,600 feet, the tracks were covered with snow. And there's a sign of a small fire under a large Siberian pine at the edge of the forest. Nearby, there were bodies of Kirvoroshenko and Doroshenko, shoeless and dressed only in their underwear. They both died of hypothermia. There were also branches broken overhead, suggesting someone had tried to climb the tree for shelter or firewood, like they had tried to rip some branches down.
Okay.
Between the pine and the camp, searchers found 3 more bodies, Dyatlov, Kolmorogrova, and Slobodin. They seem to have died trying to return to the tent. They were found separately at distances of 300, 480, and 630 meters from the tree.
Mm.
Then finding the remaining team members took another 2 months. In May, they were found under 4 meters of snow in a ravine 75 meters further into the woods from the pine tree away from the tent.
Oh, my God.
So they went the other direction.
So they split up and went 2 different directions.
Yeah.
Ugh.
3 of those 4 were better dressed than the others, and there were signs that those who died first had relinquished some clothes to the others. Dubinina was wearing Krivoroshenko's burned, torn pants, and her left foot and shin were wrapped in a torn jacket.
Oh my God. I just got chills. Okay.
Ooh.
Creepy.
Ooh,
okay.
Because it's cold.
That too, but that's creepy. Okay.
So there had to be 2 sets of autopsies, right? Because one was...
Well, they were 4 months or 2 months
They found one
apart.
Group and yeah, then, yeah. Yeah. So one was on the first group. They found that the victims died 6 to 8 hours after their last meal. There were no injuries that would have led to their deaths, and it was concluded that they all died of hypothermia.
Mm-hmm.
Slobodin had a small crack in his skull, but it wasn't a fatal blow.
Okay.
Exams on the second set of bodies shifted the narrative about the incident. There were fatal injuries this time. Thibault Brignoles had a major skull damage. Both Dubinina and Zolotoryov had major chest fractures, and one examiner said that the force taken cause this would have been equal to a car crash.
Yeah, because chest, your sternum is like one of the sturdiest bones in
Pretty
your
strong.
Body.
Yeah, so it just crushed.
Oh my God.
3 of the bodies had no external injuries that would have resulted in bone fractures as if they had no external injuries that would have resulted in bone fractures as if they'd been subjected to extreme pressure.
So basically like they'd been crushed.
Yeah. Just crushed.
Oh my God.
Dubinina and her poor face. She was found missing her tongue, eyes, and part of her lips and some of her facial tissue as well as a fragment of her skull.
Ugh.
She had extensive skin maceration in her hands, which I found out is skin maceration is like, you know, when you like leave a Band-Aid on too long and like you wash your hands. You leave the Band-Aid on, and then it's, like, all pruny when you take the Band-Aid off.
Yeah,
that's
like
maceration.
Slimy and pruny.
Yeah, it's called maceration.
I didn't know that. That's okay. That's a new word.
Yeah. I learned that.
And it's gross in general, but now in this context, it's even grosser.
It's even grosser. So part of her hand is all like that. It's all pruny.
Gross.
Apparently, she was found lying face down, and her external injuries were in line with decay in a wet environment and were likely associated with her death. So, sorry, girl.
Oh, gross. Poor thing.
At the time, the verdict was that all the group members died of a compelling natural force, and since there was no guilty party to be found, the case was closed as of May of 1959.
Wow.
So there's some theories about the incident.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering where theories were coming in.
One of the first suspected possibilities was the Mansi people, like a nearby native tribe that had attacked and murdered them for encroaching on their lands. But there were no other footprints around the campsite, and they ruled that out pretty fast.
But of course, that's the first thing. When in doubt, blame the natives. Exactly. Of course.
But there was also no sign of a struggle either. Everybody walked away from their tents on their own
willingly,
accord.
They weren't dragged away. Okay, yeah.
Then they also thought about animal attacks, but that was ruled out because of lack of any external injuries again. Mm-hmm. There was no blood anywhere, and the only one potentially eaten by an animal was Miss Dubonina.
Right.
Then hypothermia. The cold weather makes people do really weird things, like leave their tent.
Yeah.
Because they think they're burning.
I mean, I guess, yeah.
But again, everybody walked away.
Yeah.
Another really popular theory was an avalanche.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds logical because snow could crush a person.
Oh, yeah. An avalanche could really mess you up.
Yeah.
But an American skeptic author, Benjamin Radford, writes a pretty plausible theory about the incident. He writes, quote, "The group woke in a panic and cut their way out of the tent either because an avalanche had covered the entrance to their tent or because they were scared that an avalanche was imminent. Better to have potentially repairable slit in a tent than a risk being buried alive in it under tons of snow."
Right.
"They were poorly clothed because they had been sleeping and ran to the safety of the nearby woods or where trees would help slow oncoming snow. In the darkness of night, they got separated into two or three groups. One group made a fire. Others tried to return to the tent to get their clothing since the danger had apparently passed. But it was too cold and they froze to death before they could locate their tent in the darkness. At some point, some of the clothes may have been swapped for the dead. But at any rate, the group of four whose bodies were most severely damaged were caught in an avalanche and buried under 13 feet of snow. More than enough to account for the compelling natural force the medical examiner had described."
Right. Quote. Yuck. Yuck.
Ooh. But there's a lot of evidence against an avalanche being the case. The location of the incident did not have any signs of an obvious avalanche having taken place there. Debris should have been everywhere.
Right.
Bodies were found in a pretty shallow layer of snow, and somebody should have been bleeding under all that. There were over 100 expeditions there since, and no one has reported avalanche conditions. There was a study of the area using new technology determined terrain-related physics made it pretty unlikely that an avalanche would occur there.
Okay.
Dietlov was an experienced hiker and much older than much older Zolotaryov guy.
Right.
Was studying for his master's certificate in ski instruction and mountain hiking. And so these guys were not dumb men.
Yeah. Well, they wouldn't have camped out in an avalanche.
Exactly.
Zone.
Although our technology is much better now, so there may be...
True.
But it was also 1959. This wasn't that long ago when you think about it.
Not really.
Even though the pictures are black and white, but it was also still the Soviet Union, too.
Yeah.
The footprint patterns were not consistent with people leaving the tent in a panic. In fact, they were at a normal, leisurely pace.
So they weren't running?
Nope.
If it was an avalanche, they would have been running.
Yeah. These people
walked away buck naked.
Calmly, buck naked. Or with a little bit of clothes on because some people ended up with everything.
Yeah, that's still weird, though.
It's like they played a really, really, really intense game of strip poker. One person got everything.
Oh, my God.
It didn't go well. Sorry, guys.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So another possibility is infrasound-induced panic. It was popularized by Donnie Eicher's 2013 book, Dead Mountain. Wind going around a nearby mountain created a Karman vortex effect, Karman vortex street, which can produce infrasound capable of inducing panic attacks in humans. The infrasound generated by the wind as it passed over the top of a nearby mountain was responsible for causing physical discomfort and mental distress in the hikers. Eicher claims that because of their panic, the hikers were driven to leave the tent by whatever means necessary and fled down the slope.
Right. I have heard of infrasound before. Mm-hmm. It was in some horror story I read from the No Sleep subreddit. But so I've heard of it before.
And it looks like there's a weird little gif that I found. It basically looks like that. And that tuft of air hitting you over and over and over again.
Right.
That would just drive
it would cause
crazy.
Weird sound vibrations. That's creepy.
Exactly.
I like the colors they use, though. It reminds me of those old Dixie cups from the 80s and 90s.
Exactly. So that's how they got it. It was driving you crazy. But by the time they got away from the area, they regained composure and tried to return to their belongings with their heads on straight, so to speak.
Right.
The traumatic injuries of the other hikers were caused by falling onto a rocky ravine.
Okay. I guess that would make sense.
Yeah. So they would be fighting against this one pocket that maybe the wind shifted. And when they set up camp, it was fine. But then after a while, it was just driving them mad.
And then when they got far enough away, it like they cleared up and were like, oh, crap, what have we done? We have to get back. Okay. By then it was too late.
Too late.
Ugh. Okay.
Then there's the possibility of military involvement. Some speculate that the campsite fell within the path of a Soviet parachute mine exercise. The hikers, woken by loud explosions, fled the tent in a shoeless, shell-shocked panic and found themselves unable to return for supply retrieval. Parachute mines detonate while still in the air rather than on the ground, producing injuries similar to the like what the hikers had.
Right.
There are records of these tests being conducted in that area at the time.
But at the same point, if I heard major explosions go off, I wouldn't casually stroll out of I would rip my way out of the tent. But I wouldn't then casually stroll, like Sunday stroll, naked in the snow down to the...
Isn't that such a weird thought?
Yeah, so it's like, if it was explosions, they would have been running.
Yeah. I don't know.
That seems so... It seems really bizarre to me that they would rip out of the tent and then casually stroll.
Yeah.
Those just don't seem to work together. Usually it's like, if you're going to rip out of the tent, you're going to run.
And then that some of them were like crushed too.
Yeah.
With no external
injuries.
With
nothing to crush them. That's weird.
There's also another similar theory with radiological weapons, partly based on the discovery of radioactivity on some of the clothing, as well as the bodies being described by relatives as having orange skin and gray hair. But the radioactive dispersal would have affected all of the hikers' equipment instead of just some of it. And the skin and hair discoloration can be explained by a natural process of mummification after the, like, 3 months of
being buried under the snow. Yeah, absolutely.
Then, of course, I get to step on Sammy's toes a little bit. In the 2014 Discovery Channel special, Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives, explored the theory that the Dyatlov group was killed by a Menk or a Russian Yeti. The show suggests that the skier's injuries were caused by a creature with superhuman strength. In this, two members of the search party that found the destroyed campsite detail finding one set of footprints that was much larger than all the rest that were never included in the official government report.
The abominable snowman.
The abominable snowman. So then on April 12th of last year, the remains of Semyon Zolotaryov were dug up on the initiative of journalists of a Russian tabloid. Contradictory results were obtained. One of the experts stated the characteristics of the injuries resembled a person knocked down by a car, and the DNA analysis did not reveal any similarity to Zolotaryov's actual living relatives. So they gave the old switcheroo.
So he wasn't who he said he was.
Exactly.
He was a Russian spy.
Could have been. He very well could have been.
In Russia.
Or a German spy. Who knows?
Because
in addition, the name of Semyon Zolotaryov was not on the list of anybody buried at the Ivanovsky Cemetery.
Ooh.
Investigators constructed the face of the skull that was dug up from the grave, and even though it does match the bone structure of post-war pictures of Semyon's, the journalists expressed suspicions after a person was found hiding under the name of Semyon Zolotaryov after the war.
Well, that's weird.
And then the region where the hikers died was closed to the public at the time for 3 years and following the incident, but is now back open. And that's all I have to say about the Dyatlov incident.
That's, wow.
Isn't that weird?
That is weird. So, and I don't get it, though.
I know. I still, like.
Like, all those explanations, none of those, to me, fit.
Mm-mm.
None of those fit.
Like, what the heck happened? Like, obviously they're not okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I hope they get well soon. But, wow, like, that's just. Yeah, like I said, none of those explanations, like, they seem, I don't know, all of those explanations seem to only answer, like, one or two questions, but not all of the questions.
Yeah.
You know, like, some of it'll fit here, but it won't fit the rest, and then another one will fit here, but one, it's like, my biggest thing is, if they were so panicked to rip out of the tent, why didn't they panic and run away?
Exactly.
But no, they panicked and ripped out of the tent and were like, oh, okay, we're out now, let's take our time.
Yeah.
We're naked. It's below zero in like Siberia. And then let's just casually stroll.
And then they get away and then they hide like in this like little, they try to make like a little fire.
Yeah.
And then they obviously like burn himself a little bit trying to like make this little fire. And then some of them try to go back.
Yeah.
But then obviously they don't make it. It's just bizarre. It's all bizarre. It's so bizarre. So I guess we'll never know what really happened.
Oh, that's so weird.
So strange. So I guess we'll leave it to you guys. What do you guys think happened? Let us know. conspiraciesencryptids@gmail.com.
Or even just tweet at us what you think.
Yeah.
You know, because
at Cryptopod.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I want to hear your guys's thoughts on this. I mean, it's a cold case, you know, so a cold case. Wow, I didn't realize that was literally unintentional. It was a cold case during the Cold War. Oh my God.
And
okay,
with that,
we're done.
We're going to give up. Okay, guys. Have a wonderful evening, okay. Good afternoon, or good morning, whatever you're listening to us.
We'll be back again on June 1st.
Yes. Whatever day it is.
I don't know what day June 1st is.
I don't know what day today is. Why do we date anything?
I don't know.
Let's stop dating things. Date Sammy, not the podcast.
Yes, Sam, I'll go on a date.
Yes,
anybody.
Sammy will go on a date.
Just ask me out. I'll say yes.
But don't forget when you're on your date. Just always keep in mind. Just, you know, never forget.
That Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiraciesencryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cryptipod. That's CRYPTIPOD. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at Cryptopod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.